Well, hey, how are you guys today? All right. Yeah, I like it. I like it. Hey, I'm super pumped about Kids Week this week. So far, we've had 25 kids in the last 2 days, which is awesome. And we've had kids from Mercy Hill come in the student ministry that's there. So can we thank the Mercy Hill students for coming with us? It's just been so helpful, so awesome. Very encouraging for us to have our sending church send a group up here to help with that. As you can see from the stage, the kids have had a blast, you know, out in the hallway and all of that. We've had a really good time. And I want to say a special welcome to you, too. If this is your first time with us because of Kids Week, thank you for being here. We're super thankful that you would entrust your children to us. Make sure you stop by the first-time guest table on the way out. If you didn't do that on the way in, we have a first-time gift that we would love to send to you there because we just want to say thank you. Thank you for giving up your time to be here. So we take that very seriously with new guests that are here. And if you are new, I want to just catch you up because we've been in a series here called Made for More, talking about Abraham's story. And most people in our context have heard of Abraham, right? Abraham, he's the father of many. You know, Abraham had many sons, and many sons had Father Abraham, right? So most people in our context have heard of Abraham. Most people know that he was God's friend. Most people know that he followed God with his life. He wasn't perfect by any means, though, was he? We've seen in our series so far that he's done some pretty bad stuff, as in, like, he was kind of a terrible person, okay? Abraham was kind of a horrible guy. He did a bunch of bad stuff, but in our story today, we start to see some redemption here because Abraham finally gets to where God has been growing him over years and years of walking with God. We're going to see that. So we're going to be in Genesis chapter 22. If you want to turn there, find it on your device. It'll be on the screens as well if you need it today. But let me tell you this story that I heard from another pastor that I think might help you get into the mood for what we're going to be talking about today. It's very relevant. It's about a college student who went to take a final exam at the end of the semester in his ornithology class. So anybody remember what ornithology is? It's birds. Study of birds. I think I heard it out there. So very good. It's the study of birds. Maybe you remember that. I don't know. It's very interesting. So the student was taking this class. It's kind of one of those useless electives that you have to take in college. You know, sometimes they make you do that. And he's like, man, I'm very worried about this because I don't want to fail in this useless elective. I'm going to ace this exam. So I'm going to study as hard as I possibly can. You know, I'm not going to let this one test, you know, ruin my entire GPA for my degree just because I'm taking an ornithology class. So he studies and studies for hours and hours, right? And as he walks into the class to take the final exam at the end of the semester, he was very dismayed to see that up on the screen there were 25 pictures, but they weren't of birds. There were 25 pictures of birds' feet, and that was it. That was the final exam. You had to identify 25 birds by their feet. And man, he was just indignant at this point. He looked up, he yelled at the professor. He was like, hey, I'm not doing this. This is not fair, right? This isn't fair. You can't make us identify birds based on their feet. So the professor was like, well, you have to. I mean, this is the final exam, so you've got to do this. And the student was like, well, I'm not doing this. I'm going to walk out. And the professor said, well, I'll fail you if you walk out right now. And so the student said, well, I'm walking out. You can fail me. That's what's going to happen. And the professor, as the student's walking out, the professor calls back to him and says, hey, what's your name? And the student, with as much indignation as he could get up in his voice, he turned around and said, I don't know. You tell me, professor. You tell me. And he raises up his legs. And he says, yeah, huh? Look at my legs. Can you tell, you know? And obviously, I better pull these down. They're a little tight. So. Obviously, that's a funny example. It's not true, by the way. That did not happen. This is an untrue story. But it's a funny example to say that sometimes we're looking at tests that are given by the powers that be, and we'll think, man, that's unfair. This test is very unfair because tests aren't supposed to show us, you know, something that we haven't learned. They're supposed to show us what we have learned. They're not supposed to trick us. They're not supposed to intentionally set us up to fail. They're supposed to help us see what's gotten inside of us, what we've learned over a period of time. And as we look in at Abraham's life, he's going to face many tests throughout his life, but perhaps the most important and maybe the most difficult is this test that we're going to read today in Genesis chapter 22. And we might be inclined to look in at it and say, that's unfair. The test is unfair. How could God do this? But God was teaching Abraham something to grow his faith, and he was showing him what's really inside of him now. I mean, that's what tests do. A fair test, anyway, will reveal what's gotten inside of us. And God's trying to reveal Abraham's heart here. What's gotten inside of him? The deepest part of who he is now. Where his faith truly lies.
So he said he trusted God, but did he really? That's the question that's going to be answered here today. And thankfully, Abraham does seem to finally get it in this moment, and he surrenders everything to God. That's what faith is. Faith is a surrendering of everything that we are, everything that we have in our life, holding nothing back from God. So our takeaway for today in the sermon, if you're taking notes and you want to write this down, is we are to surrender everything to God. And that's it. Very straightforward, very simple today. Surrender everything to God. That's the takeaway. Now, it took a long time for Abraham to get there, right? We've seen in his story so far, this is probably about 30, maybe even 40 years out from where God first gave him a promise way back in Genesis chapter 12 here. So this has been a long time coming for Abraham. Day in and day out, walking with God, trusting his promises, doubting and fearing and failing, we've seen, and then trusting God again, going back to trusting. But he finally learned to surrender everything here in this story, I think. I think that's what the Bible's pushing us to. And the thing about it is, we wouldn't know, if God hadn't tested him, we wouldn't know how faithful he is. See, the test puts the seal on it. The test is like the final thing that says, yes, this is who you are now. As much as we don't like tests, they show us what's really going on inside, don't they? And I say this to our church all the time, but what we actually do matters in life. What we do matters. Now, we're so used to, in our Western context, thinking in hypotheticals, like, well, what if this and what if that, and we should do this or we shouldn't do that, or what would happen if, and all of this kind of stuff. And man, that's fine if we're trying to figure out how to really live in life, if it translates to actual living. But at the end of the day, the hypotheticals have to lead to action or they're kind of useless. You know, what we end up doing matters more than what we could or would or should do in some sense. And the only way to figure out if something's real is to test it. The same way you might test gold or a diamond to see if it's genuine, God tests our faith to see if it's genuine. And he does this with Abraham here by asking him to do something we might see as unimaginable, to offer up the life of his only son. So let's read this story here starting in Genesis chapter 22. We're going to be right in verse 1. We're going to try to read the whole thing, and we'll see why God asks this of Abraham as we go along. So here we go. Let's start with verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham's faith. Abraham, God called. Yes, he replied, here I am. So Abraham's response here is an indication that he's willing to listen to God, right? So we've seen this change over time. Because before he's responded through fear, but now it seems like he's responding in faith. It's not like when I call to my 8-year-old and I say her name and she's like, what? You know, that's not what Abraham does here. He doesn't use sass like that. He's not like, what do you want now? You know, he's like, no, here I am. I'm willing. I'm listening. God, what do you want me to do? It's the same response that we should have when God interacts with us. Whether it's through the Bible and we're reading God's word, or whether it's through a friend's godly wisdom in our lives, or maybe in prayer or something else, we need to be willing and ready to obey God when we hear him speaking to us. You know, he talked through a donkey one time, so he can do it through any means that he wants to. But typically, usually, he speaks to us through his word, right? He speaks to us maybe even through biblical truth and wisdom that a friend is speaking into our lives. So when's the last time you really studied God's word? It's a good question to consider. When's the last time you really dug in, you really studied what God was teaching us and saying to us? When's the last time you were open to advice from a trusted friend or brother and sister in Christ who's trying to speak biblical wisdom into your life? All good things to consider if you want to be willing and ready to obey God and follow him. But one thing we know is when God calls, it's a very good idea to listen to that call, even when it's to do something difficult in our lives. We want to be willing there. This is what happens with Abraham. In verse 2, he says, take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much. Go to the land of Moriah and go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will show you. Oh, my. Man, how can God ask him to do this thing? It sounds like such a horrible thing. Is God asking for a child sacrifice like some of the pagan gods of this era? Well, I'll give you two answers. The first answer is the short answer. It's no, okay? That's not what God is asking. God hates child sacrifice. We see that throughout the Old Testament. You know, he doesn't want child sacrifice. You know, so he even punishes Israel later on for doing that to a god named Molech, a little g god. So the longer answer, though, is that this is something Abraham would have immediately understood when God asked him of this. Because the firstborn son represented something very special to the people in those days. The firstborn represented everything that a family or individual had or looked forward to in their life, like everything. This represented life itself to a family. And to Abraham, Isaac would have represented the fulfillment of God's promise, as we talked about last week. Yeah, God had made this promise so long ago, and this represented everything that God was offering to him. Isaac represented every blessing, every good thing, every future hope that Abraham had. And in some ways, he was even what Abraham was living for the rest of his life until he died. Why would God ask this of Abraham? Well, it's because God tests our willingness to give him everything. So you can write that down if you're taking notes. God does this. He tests. You're like, God tests us? Yeah, he tests our faith. The Bible teaches us this over and over and over again. Are we really willing to give him everything? Because that's the call on our life. So are we really willing? And lest we think it's unfair, let me ask it this way. How can we know that our faith is genuine unless we're faced with a moment where we actually have to give him everything or not, right? There comes a choice where we either say, yes, I'm giving you everything, or no, I'm not going to do that. See, tests show what's really inside. It's like how an emergency will test the kind of person you are. An emergency situation comes up. Are you a fight? Are you a flight? You know, it'll show your mettle, if we can use that kind of language. Maybe this is not a good example. Maybe it's a great example. I'm not sure. But I've seen this TV series called Bay or Bail. Has anybody seen this? It's an A&E series. Anybody? Nobody? Come on. Okay. All right. Maybe it's just me. This is where somebody sets up an elaborate prank for their significant other and to see if in an emergency situation, their significant other will either protect them or flee and try to save their own life. Okay? That's probably terrible relationship advice, but it brings up a very interesting situation and scenario because somebody wants to test whether or not this person that says they're committed to them is actually committed to them. And so they'll set up something like, you know, a fake science experiment or whatever it is. And if it goes wrong, then there's toxic gases that come out. And so inevitably it goes wrong because that's the prank. And they see whether or not the boyfriend is going to run away and save his own life so he doesn't get the toxins, or if he's going to run in and try to save his girlfriend and bring her out. You know, and again, that has wrecked many a relationship on this show, I'm sure. It's probably a terrible idea to do that, but it's very interesting that somebody wants to know how deep the commitment actually goes. They want to put it to the test because what happens actually matters, right? In a sense, that's kind of what God does with our faith. I don't want to, you know, make light of it. That's kind of what it means here, that God tests us in these moments. I said it a minute ago, but you can write it down this way. What we do matters to God. How we live our lives matters. It's not hypothetical. It's actual. He's made a world where our choices and actions, not just our thoughts, not just our words, not just what we could or might or should do, matter. Although those are important things. I don't want to downplay those. Those are important to consider and think about. Our thoughts do matter, you know, our words do matter, but he's made a world where what we actually do matters. The actions we take, God's not interested in the theoretical, he's interested in the actual for us. Is your faith genuine? Does it have action? Is it like what James talks about? Is it a real faith, a living faith, or is it a dead faith? You just say you have faith, but you don't do anything with it. So testing is the way that God gets to the bottom of that in our lives. What testing does is it grows and matures us to live in a manner worthy of our calling, if we could use Paul's language from Philippians. God starts a good work in us, and he will see it to completion, and he uses testing to do that. We're called to live out the salvation that he's working in us with fear and trembling, and the tests give us an opportunity to actually do that in our lives. A couple of clarifications here, though. I know we might be thinking some of these things. Does that mean that God tempts us to sin and to do wrong things? Is that what the test is, to tempt it? No, that's not what's happening here. James 1 is very clear. God never tempts us to do wrong. He's giving us the opportunity to do right. That's what a test is here. It also doesn't mean he brings about every hard thing in our lives as a test. He doesn't just make every hard thing happen. In other words, we live in a broken world where bad things happen as a result of sin, as a result of bad choices of others, as a result of just brokenness in the world that we live in. So God doesn't necessarily make the natural disaster happen on you to test you, right? He doesn't give you a loss in your life to test you. He hates those things. He's sad. Those things grieve him. But you better believe that God wastes no time in those bad circumstances, right? He does use everything in our lives for his purposes. He wants to do something in us so that he can eventually do something through us, and he wastes no opportunity, no circumstance to test us in those things and to grow our faith and to mature our faith. So with Abraham, God is testing him, and he actually does what God asks here. Surprisingly, I think after we know who Abraham is, and we've been studying this, but this is what verse 3 says, "The next morning Abraham got up early, and he saddled his donkey, and he took two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac, and then he chopped wood for a fire for a burnt offering and set out for the place that God had told him about." So you can imagine that Abraham in this moment, what he must have been feeling through this. Because just because he was willing to listen to God in this moment and have faith in God doesn't mean that it was easy, right? I mean, I can imagine him agonizing over this, wondering why God would do this, but trying to trust God in these moments. If it were like Hannah with Samuel, maybe you remember that story in 1 Samuel, you could kind of understand it, because in her story, she can't have kids, and she begs God, "Hey, if you give me a son, I will give him back to you." And so God answers and hears her prayer, and he answers. He gives her his son, and then she gives him back into his service in the temple with Eli, and that's where Samuel goes. And you can like, okay, I can get that. I can understand that, how that we can get to that conclusion with Hannah. But killing Isaac, offering him up as a sacrifice, God really wants him to give him Isaac in this kind of way? How is it even remotely appropriate that Abraham would consider this, let alone that God would ask it? See, it says Abraham got up early and he set out for the place that God was directing. He listened to God in this moment. And some people look in and think that Abraham actually failed the test. You know, several people that I read on this week thought this. Soren Kierkegaard, who was a famous philosopher, was also a Christian. I don't know if anybody knew that. He's taken a philosophy class. But he was indignant that Abraham would have even considered listening to God on this. He thought the test was for God to ask and for Abraham to say, "No, I shouldn't do this." And for God to be like, "Yeah, you're right. That's my boy." I mean, that's what he thought. He was like, "I can't believe God would never ask such a thing. He wouldn't be serious about this." Abraham failed the test. But I think that kind of perspective misses the point of the story here, because if we understand the significance of the language surrounding the firstborn child, that's what Isaac represented to Abraham, was everything in his life, everything that was good. The firstborn was a symbol of everything somebody in ancient times would hold dear in their life. Their ability to have a future lineage, their future hope and happiness, their wealth and health at some level, even their very life itself. That's what the firstborn would represent. And this is what retired pastor Tim Keller said of this situation. He said, "If Abraham had thought God had told him, 'Kill Sarah, and then I know you love me,' he would have never done that. He would have concluded that he was hallucinating, because God would not have commanded a senseless murder like that. And God would not have said it, because it would have been murder. But when God said, 'Offer Isaac,' Abraham knew exactly what that meant. The firstborn. It represented his very life and the debt that every man owes to God. So the firstborn came to represent the debt that we all owe to God, because we all owe him everything. Even, or maybe especially, our first and our best, as we talked about with Abraham and tithing a few weeks ago with Melchizedek. But here's how you can write it down if you're taking notes. We owe God everything. We owe everything to God. We owe him everything. The firstborn child represented that for Abraham. Everything in his life. He finally came to a place after 30 or 40 years that he could say, "I will give you everything. Everything I have in my life is yours." That represented it for Abraham, Isaac, Isaac's life. My question for us is, what represents that for you? What is your Isaac today? Maybe it's your literal children if you're a parent. You know, maybe it's the hopes and dreams you have for your children. Or maybe it's your future hopes and dreams for yourself if you're not a parent today. Or maybe it's the amount of money you have in your bank account today. Or maybe it's something even more subversive than some of these things. Maybe it's something like the amount of time that you're willing to give up to serve others. Or maybe it's how much you desire pleasure in your life or a comfort in your life. Or maybe it's something like you need approval from others and you can't let go of. You gotta have approval or else life is not worth living for you. Whatever it is, that's your Isaac that you just can't imagine living life without. Here's a way to ask it so that you can get to the bottom of this for yourself. What's the one thing in your life that you just don't think you could live without if it were taken away? What's the one thing you can't imagine your life without? What's the one thing you don't want to live apart from in your life? I'm giving you time to think about it. That's your Isaac. We all have one, so don't be fooled, okay? We all have an Isaac in our life at some level. If your name's Isaac, I'm so sorry, okay? Using the story here, okay? But here's what an old Dutch theologian and culture leader named Abraham Kuyper said about this in a speech that he gave to a group of university students, as a matter of fact. He said, there is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. We can't hold on to the Isaacs in our life. All we have, even those things that we most hold dear, are God's. Are we willing to recognize that? Do we really trust God with that? Do we really believe that's true? Are we willing to give everything back to God? Because we know it's all His anyway. God was telling Abraham, I've made this promise to you, but you owe me everything. You owe me everything, including your son. Give him back. Will you do that today? And to our surprise, Abraham listens. This is what he says in verse 4. On the third day of the journey, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Stay here with the donkey, Abraham told the servants. The boy and I will travel a little further. We will worship there, and then we will come right back. Now, I don't know about you, but I can imagine that these 3 days are very difficult leading up to the mountain here. They've got to be excruciating for Abraham. Again, it's not easy just because you're listening to God. If it had been me, I can't say that I wouldn't have turned around in these 3 days, that I wouldn't have doubted and said, nah, God can't be asking this of me. I'm not going to do this. See, we get a glimpse into Abraham's faith here, right? We get a glimpse into what's actually inside. Because he even tells the servants they'd both go and worship God, and then they would both return. Hebrews 11 clarifies this for us and says that Abraham believed God would raise Isaac from the dead, trusting God that they would both return. So he trusted God here. He just didn't know how it was all going to work out, perhaps. But he trusted God, and then on the third day, he looked up, and he saw where God was taking him. The time had finally come to climb the mountain and to build the altar, which I'm sure that only made it harder. It started to get very real for him in these moments because this was the last hour here. He saw where he had to go. It wasn't easy. And he started to climb the mountain. So I think the way for us to think about it is the third day represents our resolve to trust God when it's time to climb the mountain. When it starts to get hard, we got to have some resolve here. So write this down as encouragement. Trust God even when it's hard. Man, trust God even when it gets hard, even when the mountain's right in front of you. It's time to start trusting God. For Abraham, it had to be agonizing to climb that mountain and know what was going to come at the top of it. But the only thing that could have sustained Abraham on that third day when he saw where he had to go was his trust in God. The relationship that he'd built with God over years. One pastor I listened to this week made the observation that maybe one of the reasons why the Christian life is a grind for you and you begrudgingly follow after God and you show up at church every week because you have to, not because you want to. You tithe because you have to, not because you want to. You do what's right because it's the right thing to do, not because you want to and because you love God. It's because you don't quite trust God yet. Maybe you're still looking over your shoulder like Lot's wife did. Instead of looking ahead at the mountain that God is calling you to and calling you to climb and doing it because you trust God. That's the call for us. You show me a Christian who's always frustrated and always fearful and always struggling, and I'll show you a Christian who still struggles with trusting God. They want to trust themselves. But you show me a Christian who faces even the hardest things, as difficult as it may be, as crazy as it may sound, but they face it with courage and with peace and with hope. I'll show you a Christian who's learned to trust God because they know how good He is. See, on that third day, what drove Abraham up the mountain wasn't his own resolve. It wasn't the strength of his own character. It wasn't him saying, I can do this. It's not like the little engine who could, okay? It's not like that. What it was him saying, God is faithful, and I trust Him, and He can do this through me. You know, as he climbed the mountain, he had to be recounting God's faithfulness over this time, over and over and over again in his mind, reminding himself of the God who promised him this lineage, reminding himself that God is faithful, reminding himself that all the ways that God has been faithful in his life and these promises that he's made, he's been gracious, he's been good. The only thing that can drive us onward when things get hard and we have to climb the mountain, whether it's in marriage, our marriage is getting difficult, or whether it's in parenting, parenting's hard, or whether it's in our job, or whether it's in ministry, like where I'm at, or whether it's in difficult circumstances or great loss. The only thing that can keep us going is unwavering trust in the God who keeps his promises. Verse 6, so Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders while he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them walked on together, Isaac turned to Abraham and said, Father. Yes, my son, Abraham replied. We have the fire and the wood, the boy said, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering? God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son. Sorry, it's a little emotional for me. Abraham answered, and they both walked on together. So we need to realize here that Isaac wasn't an idiot, right? Isaac knew what was going on. He knew something was up anyway. He didn't maybe not quite sure exactly what it was, and it would become clearer as they climbed the mountain together. I mean, he was old enough to carry the wood on his back, so most commentators think he was probably 15 to 18 years old, so he's a teenager. Yet he willingly goes up the mountain with his father, knowing that something, he doesn't know the whole picture, but he knows something's going on here, and yet he trusts his father anyway. I think that's just a testament to how much Abraham has been transformed by God over these last 30 or so years, because parents, you know this, your kids watch everything you do and say. Like, they mimic you. They mimic your good habits and your bad habits, right? They watch you and how you live your life. They'll put their faith in whatever you put your faith in. And Abraham had learned to trust God, and it's evident because Isaac trusted God here too. He trusted his father. They had a good enough relationship for him to trust his father, but he trusted his heavenly father as well because he saw how much Abraham trusted God. Parents, we have to live out our faith in front of our children so they'll do that one day as well. Because what you say, what you do, how you live, it preaches a lot louder than anything you can ever try to preach to your children with words. I'm bad about preaching, okay? I like to preach to my kids. But how they see me live my life, that preaches louder than anything I could ever say to them. No amount of theological training can give them that. No amount of Christian school, no amount of youth group, no amount of anything can give that to them like them seeing how I live my life and how I trust God or don't. My faith will impact them more than anything. Are you living in a way that shows your kids you trust God? It's good for us to consider. Because when you do, hopefully you'll get to walk on together in the faith, even climb mountains together like Abraham and Isaac did here. Let's finish out the story, verse 9. When they arrived at the place where God had told them to go, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. And then he tied his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Again, we see Isaac, who had the ability to overpower his very old, probably, you know, starting to be frail father here. They walk up the mountain together. He carries the wood on his back. He probably helps build it. It says Abraham did, but I'm sure he probably helped build the altar. He climbs up onto the wood himself. Think about that. Isaac willingly lays down on the altar, willingly gives his life into the hands of his father. And Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son as a sacrifice. At that moment, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. I'm sure Abraham was sweating it out and goes, yes, yes. Yes, what are you? Here I am. The angel said, Don't lay a hand on the boy. Do not hurt him in any way. For now I know that you truly fear God. You've not withheld from me even your son, your only son. I mean, the reason for the test was revealed right here for Abraham, right as he was about to do it, right at the moment. God miraculously provides an offering to take Isaac's place on the altar. It says, then Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. So he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham named the place Yahweh Yireh, which means the Lord will provide. The Latin version of that is Jehovah Jireh, if you've heard it in some other translations that way. To this day, people still use the name as a proverb, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. And then the angel of the Lord called again to Abraham from heaven. This is what the Lord says, because you've obeyed me and have not withheld even your son, your only son, I swear by my own name that I will certainly bless you. I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies, and through your descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me. And Abraham learned to surrender everything to God in this moment. So God came back around to those original promises he'd made and said, hey, this is what it's going to look like. You're going to bless all the nations. I'm going to bless you so that you can bless everybody else in the world. Abraham didn't fully understand what that would mean. But guess what? We do. We understand. Because see, the name of the place in Hebrew is very important. You know, when he named this, it signified something important that would happen in a place when somebody named it. And notice how Abraham didn't name this place my mountain of faith, right? Or the mountain where I asked God, where I did what God asked of me. It's not that. It's not the mountain of my obedience, even though that's kind of what the story is about, is testing Abraham's faith here. He names it, the Lord will provide. That's the name of this place. Because this is a story not about Abraham's faith, but about God's faithfulness. As awesome as it was that Abraham finally got it, it's even more awesome to consider what God did to get him there. It was years of God's patience and his kindness and his love that enabled Abraham's faith to grow over time. Years of testing, years of hardship at times. But that's what those hard tests do in our lives. They mature us or they break us. It's going to be one of the two. You think about it, right? When somebody goes through a very difficult thing in their life, either it's going to help them get closer to God or it's going to push them away from God. It's going to be one of those two things. They're either going to be more thankful and more trusting and more loving of God over time, or they're going to grow more bitter and more angry and eventually walk away from God. I mean, that's what a test does. It shows us what's really inside. I mean, in Bay or Bail, the relationship is either strengthened or lost, okay? I don't know. Again, it's kind of a good example, okay? So you think about that. Either it's there, it's not, it shows what's going on in our heart. The problem is you and I will always choose to bail on God, won't we? We're always going to choose to run away. That's what's actually inside of us. We always choose to trust in ourselves or our money or our power or something else rather than try to trust in God in these hard moments. We'll always choose to believe that our Isaacs will make us happier and more fulfilled than intimacy with God ever could. That's what we'll believe. We hope in things that we ought not hope in. So what hope do we have? Well, thankfully, God doesn't put us to the test to fail us. He doesn't do it to trick us or intentionally want us to fail. What he actually did was he put his own son to the test and sent him into our reality in space and time, in this world, with us, to do what we couldn't. It's what we call the gospel, which literally means good news for us, right? I can't help but think that that's what the author of Hebrews meant when he said that God's son was made perfect through suffering. You see, he proved his love to us through his suffering. He proved that he was willing to die for us by actually doing it. It wasn't theoretical. It wasn't something God just forgave without doing anything. No, he acted. He acted on our behalf. Wasn't theoretical, it was actual. God's son, his only son, the son whom he loved, would walk up a mountain as well. And he would carry the wood on his back in the form of a cross. By the way, scholars would say that this mountain that Abraham and Isaac went up together, that he named God will provide, it would become the same location later on as the city of Jerusalem. And in particular, the place where the temple itself was built. The place where God dwelled with his people. They climbed up this very mountain right here because he, like Isaac, Jesus, like Isaac, would climb up onto the wood as a sacrifice, willingly laying his life down in obedience to his father. But where Abraham's knife was stopped by God so that he wouldn't harm Isaac in that moment on top of the mountain where the temple would be built, God wouldn't stop the knife of his own justice from plunging into the heart of Jesus. He died for us. Jesus is the better Isaac for that reason. He's the true sacrifice. He's the spotless lamb that was slain for us, which this ram that God provided to Abraham would come to represent later on. Jesus lived the perfectly obedient life that you and I should live but don't. And then he died as the firstborn sacrifice to pay the debt that we owe. Remember, we owe everything to God. He's created us. He's the potter. We're the clay. We owe him everything, and Jesus paid everything for us on the cross. He paid it all. You can write this down. Jesus paid everything that we owe. This is the God we can trust. You and I struggle to give everything that we have to God, but Jesus didn't. You and I owe an eternal debt to God that we can't pay, but Jesus paid it. Isn't that incredible? This is the gospel that we believe. This is the God that we follow. Just like how we take out a mortgage to buy a house, for example, we owe so many hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you're a homeowner, you know this. You get into debt so that you can live every day in this house, right? We owe God everything in our life. We owe every day to him. We owe even the breath that we breathe to him so that we can live on a daily basis in this world. But it's as though Jesus came along and paid all of the debt that we owe. He absolved our mortgage for us. He paid everything. All we have to do is accept his payment. That's all we have to do. And after 3 days of death and darkness, Jesus, on that third day, something happened, right? It would become clear on the third day what God was doing on this unclimbable mountain, seemingly unclimbable mountain for Jesus. On that third day, all of his suffering, all of his pain, all of his loss, all of the testing that he went through, man, it would become clear because he rose from the dead and it sealed his payment for our debt forever. That's why we've talked about this in the series before. It's like a receipt that God gives, right? It's like a receipt to show the empty tomb is Jesus' receipt that proves he paid our debt for us. Man, will you believe that today? Will you accept the payment for the debt that you owe to God? Because God's offering it to you right now. If you're not a Christian here, man, if you haven't surrendered your life to Jesus, if you haven't given him everything, man, I'm super thankful you're here today. Whatever brought you here, why you're here, it doesn't matter. Don't leave without accepting this payment for the debt that you owe. Believe in the God who keeps his promises. He promises to save us when we call out to him. He can do that for you today, right now. If you simply call out to him, he'll do it. And for those of us who do follow Jesus, knowing that God has done all of this for us, he's not withheld the life of his son, his only son, the son whom he loved. I mean, let that lead you to obedience and joy today as a response to what he's done for us. Maybe the step of obedience for you today is baptism. We've talked about that before in this series. Man, baptism is the first step of obedience for the follower of Jesus. That's what that is. We'll actually be baptizing someone next week. At least one person. Yeah, woo! Okay, thank you. It's good stuff. Man, maybe it could be you next week. Maybe the step for you today is to recognize that you need to follow Jesus in obedience through baptism and get baptized. I don't know what it is for you. If that's you, come up after the service and talk to me during our Q&A session. We have a Q&A session after every service throughout the summer. It's going to be right up here at the front. We'll start about 5 or 7 minutes after, you know, the service ends. So come up here and talk to me about that if that's where you're at, because you need to respond today. Don't wait for that. Recognize what Jesus has done for you in obedience, and then you take a step of obedience in response. For the rest of us, though, who are following Jesus, maybe we've been baptized already, we might need to put our yes back on the table. Now, we've used that language here before. Sometimes it's just good to have that conversation with God. Is your yes still on the table? What that means is you're writing a blank check for your life and you're putting it on the table and sliding it over to God and saying, hey, whatever you want me to do with my life, it's yours. I'm not going to try, you know, I'm not going to reach back. The yes is there. What do you want from me? I put my yes on the table. You put it on the map. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? How do you want me to live? Maybe that's your response today. Because that's what it means to surrender everything. It was Abraham's obedience that enabled the nations to be blessed. You and I are sitting here today in faith because Abraham believed. Because of his obedience, we're here. Yeah, I mean, God could have used somebody else, but to Abraham's detriment, right? Abraham got to be a part of that lineage. We can be a part of somebody else's faith lineage. If we walk out in obedience today, if we put our yes on the table and surrender everything that we are to God, God can use us in the same way. He can bless the nations through us. Whoever you're around, wherever you go, God can use you to share the same good news that you've just believed, that you put your hope in. So the question I want to leave you guys with today, every one of us, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian today, is have you surrendered everything to God? Have you surrendered everything to him? Man, chances are you haven't. Because like I said, we try to grasp at that yes on the table, don't we? Even if we put it there, we still try to grab at it. when it gets hard, when we get tested, whatever the case might be. I mean, God put Abraham through this test to root out any remaining idolatry in his life. Idolatry is that thing where we place the Isaacs of our life, the thing that we can't live without. So maybe you and I need to go through a few more tests before we can say with certainty that we've surrendered everything to God. I don't know. I'd say that's probably what it's going to be in our lives. Now, I don't think that means you're not a Christian. If you're going to go through that test, if you're struggling to give God everything and you're struggling to let some things go, no, I actually think it means the opposite. I think it means you are a Christian because you care, right? You want to try to let go of everything. You want to try to give God everything in your life. It means you do believe him. You do want to trust him. You do want to follow him. Keep pressing in. If that's where you're at, keep pressing in to the relationship with God, because Abraham was at the end of his life. We're going to talk about next week how he dies. Okay, everybody dies, so we're going to talk about death next week. It took a lifetime for Abraham to believe God. He had to wait a long time, go through a lot of tests, go through a lot of hardship. He had to go through a lot in order to believe in God wholeheartedly and surrender everything to him. We've got to be willing to do whatever it takes if that's what we really believe. This is what A.W. Tozer, an old pastor from the early 20th century, wrote in his book, Pursuit of God. He said this: "We must in our hearts live through Abraham's harsh and bitter experiences. If we would know the blessedness which follows them," we've got to go through hardship, he says. "The ancient curse of sin will not go out painlessly. Oh no, the tough old miser within us will not lie down and die obedient to our command. He must be torn out of our heart like a plant from the soil. He must be extracted in agony and blood like a tooth from a jaw." Man, that's very visceral, right? "He must be expelled from our soul by violence, as Christ expelled the money changers from the temple." See, we have to be willing to do whatever it takes to surrender everything to God. So let me do a little exercise to end our time here together. I got this from Pastor J.D. Greer, who probably got it from Tim Keller and somebody else. Who knows? You know, he steals everything as well. So I'm stealing this one. I think it's really helpful. And I hope it could be life-changing for you today. This could change your relationship with God today if you take this seriously and just do this with me. Let's all close our eyes. You don't have to participate if it feels weird to you. You don't have to do it. But let's try to close our eyes in this moment. Everybody, close your eyes right now. Just think about your relationship with God. What I want you to do is hold out both of your hands just in front of you on your lap or whatever, with the palms facing up. Just like you're holding something in your lap there. Now imagine whatever is most valuable to you, whatever you think is most important to you, whatever you don't think life is worth living without, whatever you might die for, whatever your Isaac is, or maybe it's multiple things, I don't know. Imagine that's in your hands. So maybe it's your kids, maybe it's your spouse, maybe it's your career, maybe it's something else, I don't know, whatever it is, your perceived success in life, whatever it is, it's the thing that you just can't imagine your life without. You've got to have this thing, or life is just not worth living. Now I want you to squeeze your hands together and make a fist. And I want you to visualize those things that you don't want to live without inside of your fists. And I want you to squeeze with the amount of firmness that would represent how much you would hold on to that thing, how much you don't want to let it go. Visualize that there. We all have that. So I know we all have that. But this is where it gets hard. Because now, if you're willing, okay, don't do it if you're not willing. But if you're willing to give those things, whatever they are, fully over to God, only if you're willing to do it, I want you to release your hands and open them back up, palms face up, and say either out loud or in your heart at least, "Father, I give these things back to you. They're yours anyway. They're not mine. And I'm sorry for trying to make them mine. Please forgive me. And please do with them what you will." Keep your eyes closed for just a moment. Stay in this moment, because I want you to do some talking to God. I want you to really relate to him in this moment. Are you willing to say that to God? Because that's the real test for us today. Do we believe God has provided everything that we really need for hope and for happiness and for life to actually matter for us? Do we really believe he's provided that through Jesus? Or are we trusting in something else? Maybe you are. Just be real about it. I don't know. Is he really enough to satisfy you, to make your life worth living? Are you still holding something back from him? This is between you and God. It's not between you and anybody else. Nobody else probably knows this. Do this with God right now. Because it's not that God needs your Isaacs, whatever that might be for you. It's that we need God. And the only way to get him is to surrender everything. God, we need you in this moment. Please help us as a church to surrender everything that we are to you. God, please don't let us hold anything back. Help us root these things out. Tear it out of our heart, God, so that as a church, we can bless the city that we're in. We know you've blessed us with the gospel. We trust you, God. We believe in you. And if there are people here who don't believe in you and trust in you in this way, please, God, please break down the barriers in their heart. Please root that thing out, God. Rip it out if necessary. Put them through the test. And God, as we enter into hard seasons, hard situations, loss, frustrations, whatever it is in our life, God, help us to see that you wasted none of that. We have an opportunity to walk in faith in those moments or to shipwreck our faith. God, I just pray that you'll help us in those moments. Give us strength. We need you, God. I know there are people walking through that right now in our church, God. Please bless them. Help them. Father, for those of us who aren't in the test right now, help us to encourage. Help us to love. Help us to support. Because we know we're going to be in a test one day too. We're either in a storm, going out of a storm, or getting ready to go into one, right? I've heard the old preachers say that. God, help us to believe that you take us through all of it if we simply trust in you. Help us today, God, so that we can live on mission for you in this city. For our joy, but ultimately for your glory. Pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks so much for listening with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for gathering with other believers in a local church context. So if you don't have a local church, we would encourage you to plug in with one wherever you are. And if you're in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us here at Redemption Church. And you're welcome anytime to gather with us. But you can check us out online at our website, redemptionroanoke.com. You can look for other content or resources there. But thanks again for listening.